So it's a real pleasure to introduce. I may need to hold off for just one moment for people who are coming in for your talk, John, if you don't mind. Let's get the official ruling here. 2:15. Nope, we're good. Perfect time. Wow, perfect timing. So it's a real pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Dr. John Bomberg from Sturgeon Bay in Wisconsin. He's with the USDA ARS, and I've really been looking forward to your talk. I've been really intrigued about these wild species, and so here it is, Dr. Bomberg.
Thank you very much. We're going to do 25 years of potato collecting in 25 minutes, apparently. Okay. You see that my co-authors, Alfonso Del Rio and Chico Fernandez, and I are all from the U.S. Potato Gene Bank, so I thought it appropriate to say a little bit about the gene bank itself. So, U.S. Potato Gene Bank is in Wisconsin, long ways from the southwest, but up in the Door Peninsula, as you see in Wisconsin there, at Sturgeon Bay, and that's about 200 miles from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Okay, so we're part of the National Plant Germplasm System, and that's USDA maintains crop germplasm for all the major crops, and we're one of them, but we focus only on the tuber-bearing solanum species, not sweet potato or other root and tuber crops. Okay, so this slide, why is the gene bank needed? Potato is already a pretty great crop, very nutritious and palatable, and produces probably more carbohydrates per acre than about any other major crop, very palatable, but it still has a lot of challenges that we need to solve that can be addressed by genetics. So we can just go around these slides. Disease, pest, and stress are common things to all crops. You see nematodes there going around counterclockwise. Colorado potato beetle, diseases like late blight, those all still rob the crop from major production, significant production every year, right? So we'd like to fix those things. And things like stress in the form of frost sensitivity, if we could just increase that a little bit, you could expand the range of profitable potato growth. And then physiology, Rich already mentioned a lot about the whole problem of drought. Potatoes are a high water use crop, so if we could improve that through better physiology, that'd be great. And then returning back to the middle there, just yield, nutrition, and quality. Like a lot of fruits and vegetables, potatoes have pretty exacting quality standards, both in the processed and the table stock. So, you know, there are a lot of ways you can improve the crop, right? By better cultural practices, even marketing and things like that, but we're focused on genetics. So, I like to use this example from the common experience, the well-stocked toolbox, right? And you see on the left there, you've got a package that can meet just about any contingency. You've got a broad diversity of tools, some that you're going to use every day, and some that are pretty obscure that will come in a pinch that you weren't expecting. You have them well organized, you have them in working order, and you know how to use them. And so the exact same things apply to the genes and germplasm that we want to keep in the gene bank. So we want to have a broad diversity of genes. We want to have them the material classified so that we know how to access it. We want to have it in working order. That means that you have to have plenty of propagules and have them be disease-free, and you have to be able to know how to use them. So with that little introduction, let's look at just the basic mission statements of all gene banks, and in particular, we're going to emphasize acquire, which is the emphasis of this talk today. So all gene banks, not just potato, do acquisition, classify, preserve, characterize, and distribute germplasm. And when you're talking about potatoes, that's the acquisition is with respect to these 100 or so species. So potato has about 100 wild relatives, and they occur all throughout the Americas. You see all the way from the bottom of Chile up through South America, Central America, Mexico, and then up into the USA a little bit. Okay, that's where we're going to focus. out of 100 species, two in the U.S., and those are Solanum jamesii and Solanum fendleri. The range is, as you see in that little insert map there, the light-colored spot, pretty much the Four Corners states and a bit of West Texas. So you have, it's kind of nice though, because you have two of the major breeding systems in the potato species. You have on the left there, jamesii, the white-flowered one, is a diploid, a self-incompatible species, and on the right is Solanum fendleri, a disomic tetraploid. And they do occur both in the same area in the U.S., except jamesii is the only species that's up into the northern part, up into Utah and Colorado. All right, so I've broken the presentation here into three categories under our objectives. The first one was just to collect to increase the geographic and genetic diversity of these things. We didn't really know a whole lot about it, but we wanted to see if we could expand that kind of representation. And then number two, you'll appreciate that over the last few decades, we've had this great power develop in DNA markers, so we could have objective, you know, neutral markers to really get a grip on the patterns of genetics. So we wanted to make use of that. And so that's been a major emphasis of our program, especially with respect to these species. And finally, you know, it's great to go out botanizing and hiking around and collecting things and studying them, but at some point, you want to try to get those into the crop breeding pool. So we also said, hey, this ought to be our responsibility to use these species to see if we can get them moved toward the crop. So that's Alfonso Del Rio, the other author of this presentation, and myself, and we're about halfway up to the Rincons, just outside of Tucson, to Mica Peak in that area. Gives you an idea of the habitat, although potatoes don't grow exactly around here, where you see here. And then this is the guy that took the last picture, Chico Fernandez. He's been also a participant in this project for many years. And I just wanted to give you an idea of, on the left there, some of the different places that we've gone. So the typical expedition would be like about 10 days in the field, and usually try to emphasize one area and collect that rather thoroughly. You'll recognize a number of these places are Sky Islands from southern Arizona right around here. So these are the places we've been over the last dozen years or so. So this is the part about collecting to increase the geographic and genetic diversity. Well, how have we done? How have we done in covering the geographic diversity? Take a look at the map on your left there. That's the representation of fendleri. You see the red dots that were before 1992 collections, really pretty restricted area. There were only 24 of those, and then currently we have 226 collections of fendleri, represented by the black loops. And if you'll notice, there are a lot of black loops that don't have any red dots in them. So we collected for the first time in Texas, on the border area of Texas, New Mexico, and importantly, I think, up in the northwest part of the range, in the Coconino National Forest. Just recently, actually, did we discover fendleri there. So we've expanded fendleri a lot. Similar, jamesii, you see the red dots in the right-hand map, mostly along the Arizona-New Mexico border area, and the little blue flags indicate all the new collections, up to 128 now currently. And here again, we didn't have anything from Texas before 92. A lot of the area of central New Mexico was unrepresented, north-central Arizona unrepresented, and also importantly, up in Utah and Colorado wasn't represented very much before we collected. I think we expanded geographic diversity a lot. Now, I have this picture of Jack Hawks up in the corner. How does he figure in? I don't know if any of you recognize him as a very famous taxonomist, collector, researcher of exotic potatoes from Birmingham, England. Some people say yes, you do. So I wanted to tell you this story about, I think it was back like in the early 80s or so, he used to come to the gene bank and you know, do taxonomic work there. So my boss, Bob Hanneman, at one of these times, invited him to a dinner party, and the grad students, which I was one, was along there. And Jack was telling us all these adventures about collecting in Latin America, and this young guy popped up and said, "But Dr. Hawks, what about in the U.S.?" And I can still see the look on his face. He thought a second and said, "Oh, I think it's been pretty well collected in the U.S." So that's kind of amusing in hindsight, not to put any kind of disrespect on Dr. Hawks, but I'm glad I wasn't discouraged from undertaking that in the early 90s until today. So what about genetic diversity? I'm just going to give you the take-home message here. Again, we use the rapid AFLP markers to characterize all these collections. And if you look at the polymorphic loci detected before 92 versus after, for Fendleri, we've increased about 16%, and James EI a whopping 33%. So, you know, that's quite a bit within one species that you already had 20-plus populations. So we think we've increased both geographic and genetic gain in the gene bank. I also wanted to say that I think it's really important that we gain some technical experience. Maybe all you other experts would say, "Yeah, well, you just knew about what was in the gene bank and you were too dumb to know how to go out in the wild and see things." But you know, we figured it would be kind of common sense to see potato plants and identify them, but it really wasn't. So at about the 10-year mark, we published a paper giving tips and advice on how to collect, and we want to do it again. Things like, you know, where to look exactly. You've got huge expanses of appropriate habitat, but what are the real indicators of where that small cluster of potatoes is growing? And you see Alfonso on the right there also temporarily collecting meristems to bring back to the GMAC. How do you really capture this stuff in the best way? I think we have gained some insights into that as well. Okay, then on to the second section, which is using the DNA markers to study patterns of genetics. So in this case, we want to know two things. We want to know which populations are most diverse, so you can, you know, prioritize them for more collecting and preservation in the gene bank and evaluation. But you'd also like to know why, if you could somehow test different hypotheses to figure out why those populations were most genetically rich. You could say, "Oh, it's because they're spatially separated," or, "Oh, it's because the ones by mountain lakes are where the birds, you know, are carrying propagules," or any one of a dozen different things. So those are kind of the two main questions that you want to ask about studying the patterns of genetic richness. I don't have time to go into like a whole survey of everything that we've done in this area, but I'm going to give you one, what I think is a really intriguing example, and that is this so-called James EI megapopulation at Mesa Verde. So it was only in 2013 that we went there and sampled this huge population. It's like millions of plants over a valley below the ruins here, maybe 100 acres, and just carpeted with James EI, biggest population that we know of. And this is also the headquarters of the Anasazi, or the native, or the ancient Puebloans, who had these great trade routes all across the area. And so you wonder, what's going on here? Is this very mega population in size also mega in genetic diversity? Well, the answer is yes. So which populations are the richest? Mesa Verde population is. You see illustrated here in the diagram, if you take all the other James EI in the black circle, and you take just the one spot in Mesa Verde of the green circle, that captures 85% of all the polymorphic loci in the whole set. So it's very rich. It also captures 67% of all the bands that are just unique to one population. So obviously that's going to be, you know, our go-to site. It's going to be our number one core collection in the gene bank. And then the question of why, I said, why is it so rich? This intriguing question of whether it could be the result of being an ancient gene bank and center of cultivation. In other words, the human element was maybe a factor. Okay, so for geneticists, we don't know anything about that, right? So we had to form a collaboration with Elizabeth Lauterbach, who you see in the left-hand picture there from University of Utah. Last couple of years, she's an anthropologist. We've been working on looking at some of the, if there are any genetic or trait indicators that would, you know, support the idea that, yeah, humans were cultivating these things. Okay. Moving on to the third section then. I said sometimes you get really focused on your gene bank work and your exotic species and you think, well, how are we going to pay the bills, you know? Eventually all this germplasm has to generate some money and some food for people to eat, right? So we thought, okay, we've been working so much with these species, probably we should take responsibility to see if we can move them in this direction. Do these species have a lot to offer? Well, yeah, I think they do. I told you about these numerous challenges that potato crop has, and these things have a remarkable number of interesting traits, like late blight resistance. Dennis Halderman was telling me that he thinks maybe Jamesii is the most late blight resistant of all the species he's tested. A lot of insect nematode resistance, and then even some, you can read the list yourself, but even some nutritional things like very high antioxidants, and collaborating with Creighton Miller, Texas A&M, anti-prostate cancer properties in Jamesii, and then even some really interesting floral mutants, like you see the picture of that fruit there. That fruit we call Matryoshka mutant. So like, you know, the Russian nested dolls, it just has whorls of fruit within fruit within fruit within fruit. We don't know of it occurring anywhere else in the potatoes. And you see also on the right there are Jamesii tubers. Okay, so now that corresponds to the extreme tuber dormancy. So like you put a potato in a refrigerator in a paper bag, right? Maybe a year at most, or a wild species maybe 2 years. It sprouts, shrivels, and that's it, right? But Jamesii tubers in the regular refrigerated cooler, paper bag, 14 years, firm, no sprouting. You take them out and they grow a normal plant. I mean, that's amazing. So lots of really neat traits. So that's the basis for thinking how are we going to get these traits into the cultivar area. Well, there's a couple of problems, and those problems are that these species are really weedy, right? They're not adapted. They're wild. You see my assistant there, my wife Ingrid, holding up an example of a plant in the late fall. After the tops had frozen off, the plant is done. Where are the potatoes? No potatoes. Not adapted to our day lengths, right? So we've got that great weediness. And then the second problem is they don't cross very well. Very difficult to cross to cultivated species. Okay, so I'm going to just quickly tell you about two, I hazard to say, breakthroughs that we've had in the last few years with addressing those problems. The first one is using this wild species cardiophyllum from Mexico. So it might even have been the Native Americans here could have accessed that. That's maybe a stretch, but it's an interesting idea. Cardiophyllum has big tuber mutants, very rare, but in a greenhouse, you know, big tubers, and in the field. So we bred Jamesii into this big tuber background from cardiophyllum, and the result is what you see on the top there from the field in Wisconsin just a couple months ago, dug up. I mean, these tubers are, you know, a couple hundred times as big as the native Jamesii tubers that you see at the front and center there. So those are like the size of small marbles, and you're getting something that's, you know, almost in the relevant to potato crop. So that's the first approach. I don't recognize that name. The question is it Papawera? I know that it was reputed to be eaten by Mexicans, but I don't know too much about it. We consider it pretty much a wild species, the cardiophyllum. But it's an interesting question. If that was, you know, bigger tubers than that were the hand of man too, who knows? So that's the first breeding approach, is to use this big tuber mutant totally in a wild background. The second one is by making use of this other Mexican species, Salinum varicosum. So it's used as a bridge species. This isn't a technique that we developed by any means, but we're the first, I think, to apply it to Jamesii. And we've made some modifications, I think, to refine that technique. So bottom line is, over the last couple of years, we've gotten some Jamesii into the cultivated gene pool, just the first crosses, and, you know, combine those with cultivated forms. Okay, so wrapping up, I have to tell you that when this project started in 92, we weren't really thinking of expanding it so much. We were just going to see what was in the Southwest. But it's developed into, I think, a great model of comprehensive gene bank service. So, you know, what can the gene bank do from start to finish? What would you do? You'd look in your collection, and you'd see what germplasm you had in the gene bank, and you would then look to the wild and see how you could extend the geographic and genetic representation that you had in your gene bank, right? And then you would further study what was in the wild, see where they figure out where they grow, make those populations even more accessible to others. And you'd figure out which were the most rich in diversity, so you could concentrate on those in the gene bank, and you'd try to figure out why so that you could predict where to collect more. Third, all the while, you would be evaluating for useful traits, and you'd be developing the technology to incorporate those useful traits. And finally, you've got some kind of pre-bred material that you can advertise and characterize and present to the breeders and researchers. So you've covered that whole spectrum of service. So, been doing this a long time, but you might have noticed that numerous times during the talk I said, well, just in the last couple years we did this, or just in 2013 we discovered Mesa Verde diversity population. So a lot of this stuff, good stuff, has happened just in the last few years, which brings me to the conclusion that there's still more to do. So that's it.
Somebody got ahead of you by a tenth of a second, Dr. Williams, so we'll take the question in the far back first and then Dr. Williams.
Just a minute. I think you guys can hear me pretty well back there, but I can't hear you unless you shout it out, so you have to really shout it.
Yeah. And, you know, feel free.
Come on up here and talk to me, because I can't hear very well. The question was, what kind of collecting do you do with potato? You can collect fruits and seeds, which is the most desirable. That's easiest to put those in your, you know, right in your backpack. But tubers are also good. We've done some studies on this. What kind of propagules to collect? Seeds, tubers, little plantlets we've often collected, like in these old style freezer boxes, work good for that. Put them in native soil and plant and collect rooted plantlets, take them home. And I showed you the picture of Alfonso collecting meristems. We're working on that too, like in some kind of antibiotic medium, just for a week or so. And even pollen is a possibility, because there's sometimes you're collecting as well as you can in a population. Let's say you collect a bunch of fruit, but then, you know, there's a lot more plants that have pollen you could collect. We tried that, and we've looked at what the genetic impact of that is. So the number of possibilities. And for Fendleri, it might be better to collect tubers. And for Jamesii, it might be better to collect seeds. Yeah? Because of the breeding system, you know, the way the diversity is partitioned in the different species. Somebody repeat it.
Jack Hawks, once when he'd been at Sturgeon Bay and then came down to Riverside, said that there was a feeling in Sturgeon Bay that possibly the local folks here in the southwest moved the wild species around. Is that still a possibility or are you not?
The question was, did the locals, the ancient locals, I guess, move wild potatoes around? And as I suggested in that part about Mesa Verde, that's the thing that is newly under investigation. When we first met Elizabeth and other people from University of Utah, you know, that opened a whole new vistas of how these things might have been changed, right? Usually we're thinking of, okay, they naturally moved up slowly from Mexico, or were there animals that carried them around and so forth, but what about if people had? And it seemed really curious to us that interpretive centers where potatoes are growing all over, you know, Chaco or Canyon de Chelly or Mesa Verde, and interpretive centers don't say anything about potatoes. They say, oh, the ancients, you know, had this maize and they had this squash, no potatoes. What do you mean? The potatoes are growing right there. So I think probably they were used a lot more than is and traded more than is commonly appreciated. If in fact you were going traveling and you were going across the mountaintops, why wouldn't you have a sack of potatoes along to eat? It seems reasonable.
We have a question here, and then there's another question here. I was just going to say too, the
potato starch grains have been found in, you know, mixing bowls or grinding places.
Yeah.
Do you want to mention that?
That's a way to detect potato use in ancient hearths if there is starch, characteristic potato starch. And so there's work being done on that right now. The question about why the Mesa Verde megapopulation is so rich, right? Okay, I didn't say that it could be nothing to do with people. It could just be because there's so many plants there and it's like some kind of natural incubator. It's really, frankly, it's possible that the places that we sampled, other places we sampled, seem to be less diverse because any given year, you're only seeing a fraction of what's there, you know. That's one of the collecting tips that I want to publish and repeat again, you know, your sense of how robust this population is. Oh my gosh, this is a super population in this year, and then 2 years later, where are they? It's unbelievable. Sometimes the variation just in the time that you visit and collect. So we sample that population with 80 bolts, which is phenomenally more than we've sampled any other. 80 bolts of like 20 plants. We don't know. Do they sexually reproduce? We don't know. The ones that we observed when we were there, typically, and everywhere else, typically you see tuberlings, that is plants that grew up from tubers. Sometimes you see plants that you know were from seedlings. That's true for both species. And how often they reproduce from seeds, don't know. But you have to figure that with both species, that's the sexual reproduction is the backup plan. Especially James E.I., where you'd have certain genotypes that were adapted. We have research on this published, but you have certain genotypes that are adapted, and then you got a bunch of seeds in the soil, presumably, and when they're needed to come up in a different environment, they do and prosper. So,
yeah, excuse me for that blurting out earlier about how you have one, but that's so exciting. And what I was getting at is that there's still a three-state zone at the southern edge of the Tijuana Desert, up towards the Altiplano, that are towards Mexico City, where Cariapolan and what's the other one down there, Aaron Burgu or Burgui.
Yeah, there are five or six species like that.
Yeah, those are still cultivated in the markets every day, I mean every year.
Oh.
And they go for 10 to 20 times the price of regular potatoes there because they're so valued. And there used to be a weed in the crop, and then people invade fields, and they've converted to just cultivating to maintain the highest abundance of them. And so that would be a really great area to look at. I tried to bring your station up some, got them to El Paso Juarez, and was working for the USDA plant for that border guy through the 20 pounds of garbage can. And he said, well, you don't know anything about that permit. But I mean, it's this amazing thing that it's probably semi-domesticated there in that area, if not completely domesticated. Yeah. Some of these focus to Ted Ecuador and other things.
Yeah, the idea is that if you combine these big tuber cardiophyllum with Jamesii, could you detect which Jamesii had the rudiments of larger tubers that were selected for? And I don't really have exacting data on this, but the hybrids that we made have even bigger tubers than the cardiophyllum parent. And kind of scheming about how cool it would be to actually back cross larger tubers in the Jamesii, and then say, hey, you guys that are growing your native crops right here now, how would you like to have some, your own potato, you know, your own cultivated potato, not the ones that the Latin Americans, or that the South Americans domesticated, but ones that you guys domesticated, basically.
Jamesii, we were just up there, Spokane and Navajo folks, and they still know it, they cultivate it, and collect it every year, and they always use it to play,
oh, yeah.
The South American folks.
I just wondered, you mentioned that many of the plants come from tubers. Do you have a good feel for how long they persist perennially? Or do they come up and die? How long they persist?
The question was about how long do the plants persist if they've come up from tuberlings, if they're tuberlings that have come up from tubers. I think they always die back every year, and they produce a lot of small tubers. Sometimes when you're digging for tubers, you see ones, obviously you see the mother tuber, the one that was expended in this year's growth, but you also see some tubers that are not quite the same color, and the idea is that those were actually tubers that never sprouted the previous year. So we were up somewhere in southern Colorado where we had gotten a tip that there was an orchard guy who, you know, he was interested in these Jamesii, and he led us to him and told us all about him. And he said, yeah, you know, I was irrigating this part, and the plants were there, and then I moved to a different spot, and that spot was bone dry for 20 years, and when I came back, I watered it again, and the potatoes came up. He says, that shows me that Jamesii potato tubers can sit there just like seeds. And I thought, oh, yeah, we know that's impossible. But you kind of wonder, because when you see ones that really look like they're at least a year or two in the soil, I didn't mention it in the slide about the traits of these things either, but 2 years ago, we tested them for frost tolerance. Why? Tubers aren't frost tolerant, but Jamesii tubers are. Unbelievable. So I guess they're super cool, but no other tubers really super cool. Yeah. Put a potato in the freezer, and what happens? It turns to mush, right? Not Jamesii.
Henry, you have a question?
Yeah, two parts. And the first part, you don't have to answer, but
I guess the question is, kind of goes back to these two species at the top of the range, why would we do those when Latin America is the go-to spot in most people's estimation? Well, it was, okay, we have a taxonomist in our at our gene bank, a dedicated taxonomist by the name of David Spooner, and he did the South American collecting extensively, and he said, John, you can do the U.S. You know, you've been doing the U.S. Go ahead and do that. I'll do Latin America. You do the U.S. But it was never just to, do the only thing we could do. It was always to use that as a model for how collecting should be. You know, what was the nexus between the gene bank and the wild, to try to understand that better, because we don't know much at all about how what we have in the gene bank compares to what's out there potentially. And so you've got two breeding systems. You've got a place that you can easily travel to and collect. So I think it was, like this last slide, we thought it was a useful exercise to kind of run through to show from the start to finish what you do, considering the wild, the in situ situation.